For KOSU, I'm Michael Cross, and it's time for This Week in Oklahoma Politics, along with Republican political consultant Neva Hill and ACLU Oklahoma Executive Director Ryan Kiesel joining me over Zoom video conference. A state lawmaker is facing accusations he authored legislation allowing his wife to become a tag agent. Last year, Representative Terry O'Donnell authored House Bill 2098, deleting a three-decade-old ban on legislators or immediate families from owning tag agencies. Months later, O'Donnell's wife took over the Catoosa Tag Agency upon the death of her mother. Ryan, are we looking at a conflict of interest here?
I don't think so. I think that it's difficult to say that it's impossible to say that Representative O'Donnell knew whenever he was passing that legislation that his mother-in-law would tragically die 10 days after a diagnosis of pancreatic cancer. And I think that, you know, that tragic coincidence is really what I think it is here. I don't think that he was ever trying to line this up in a way so that his wife could one day take over the tag agency. I can understand that the optics of it, you know, you've got a lawmaker whose wife now has a benefit from the state. He said that he's going to take constitutional privilege, meaning that he won't vote on any future legislation dealing with tag agencies. I think it makes sense that he was authoring legislation to deal with tag agencies to begin with, because he obviously had some knowledge about how that process works. And we go way back, you know, tag agents used to be appointed by state senators, and they changed that, and now they're appointed by the Oklahoma Tax Commission. And so his language that he had back in legislation before his mother-in-law passed away that allowed this to even happen, was really trying to bring the law up to speed with other reforms that had taken that power away from the Senate a few years ago. So I think that if Representative O'Donnell really wants to, you know, clear this deal up, which I think he would want to, maybe reaching out to the Attorney General's office and asking for an opinion as to whether or not what his wife has as a contract, and if so, to act accordingly. But I don't see any immediate ethics scandal that we're dealing with right now.
Neva.
I would agree. I don't think there's, we can talk about optics sometimes when a story hits the public, and in this case, I mean, there was this kind of tainting on it that maybe there was something improper or trying to raise some doubts. And frankly, I think the backdrop to this is more about the political inside baseball of a leadership fight between folks, with Terry O'Donnell being in the mix, than it is about the particulars of this. Because really, when you get down to the bill itself, which was passed, it was the 21st Century Motor Tag Agent Act. And as Ryan said, it dealt with many issues, much of statute needing to be updated from back to the 1980s. And in this instance, it had strong, overwhelming bipartisan support in both the House and the Senate. And ironically, I mean, even Colin Waukee raising the issue on this in his news release, he himself voted for this bill. So if he thought there was bad public policy, or it was going to open the door to something like the issue that was injected in with Representative O'Donnell's mother-in-law's passing and his wife taking over the tag agent, I think we have bigger kind of political issues that always bubble up when we start talking about these tag agents nowadays. And that is that of the 300 plus tag agencies across the state, there has been a move afoot among many to try to eliminate tag agencies completely and to go another direction. So I think this is much to do about one simple storyline that people are trying to lace up with a lot of different innuendo or speculation. And I just don't see that it has much shelf life than what occurred in one story last week.
Neva, Representative O'Donnell does face a Democratic challenger in the general election. We are talking about optics. Could it affect him in the race?
I don't think so at all. I mean, first of all, you look at districts, you look at positioning. I mean, Representative O'Donnell in his district has always done exceedingly well at the ballot box. And I don't think there's any expectation that will change on November 3rd.
Yeah, and I would advise, you know, the Democratic challenger there to not make this an issue. I think that the potential for this to blow up and backfire on somebody that tried to make this an issue, I think, is greater than any sort of benefit that you'd get out of it, especially when we look at the circumstances. I mean, his mother-in-law passed away tragically 10 days after a pancreatic cancer diagnosis. And, you know, this is, you know, to try to connect all of those dots, there, you know, Representative O'Donnell has an entire legislative record. If you want to run against that, run against that. But to make this the core piece of a campaign against him, I think would be a mistake.
A newly formed group is opposing a criminal justice reform measure going before voters this November. Oklahomans United Against 805 say the state question allows repeat offenders to spend less time in prison and return to communities to commit more crimes. Neva, what do you think about the group's argument here?
Well, I think they have some legitimate arguments, and I think the fact that that what we have is a state question. We're getting in the closing stretch of the political season, and now we have a clear yes and no groups. And I think in the instance of the no group, I mean, what they are positioning is to raise doubt. When in doubt, people vote no very often in these types of state questions, and to educate on the issue. And you know, with the former governor Frank Keating and others coming out in the Oklahomans United Against 805 group, I think that they will begin to articulate their position that this is bad public policy, and they will seize upon some of the things that they believe are an overreach, as they have stated in some of the information that's been put forth thus far. And they will, I think, focus on things that resonate with the voters. I mean, when you talk about crimes such as domestic violence, second degree burglary, soliciting sex from a minor, I mean, all of these that when you look at the charges and the fact that in certain domestic violence charges, they're not eligible for the sentence enhancements. And I think when you look at this, it's going to be a real interesting education process with the public. I find it fascinating that Tricia Everest is serving as chair of this group. She also chairs the Oklahoma County Jail Trust. Mm-hmm. She's a former assistant attorney general. And she is someone certainly articulate on this. And her position is that it isn't about providing second chances for first time criminals when we talk about these enhancements. So it will be interesting to see how the public responds to this give and take yes and no on this particular state question.
Ryan,
if you look at the common denominator among each and every person that's a part of this vote no on state question 805 campaign, the one thing that you can keep coming back to is that they're all prosecutors in some level or another. They're all prosecutors. And we talked last week on the program about a young man who is right now serving a sentence of 7 years for possession with intent to distribute. He had a little bit over an ounce of marijuana on him. And again, I mentioned, as somebody with a medical marijuana card in Oklahoma myself, I can possess exponentially more marijuana than that legally. And so whether you think that should be a crime or not, the idea that he's facing 7 years, he didn't get that 7 years because of the underlying crime. He got it because he had priors. And the DA was able to stack those priors and walk into the room with the disproportionate amount of leverage that prosecutors walk into every plea negotiation with, and extract a 7-year plea out of this guy for a little over an ounce of marijuana. That's what the sentence enhancements currently allow for to happen. And you know, the prosecutors, they don't want to lose that leverage. You know, they have the ability to prosecute folks charged with domestic violence without these sentence enhancements. They have the ability to charge and prosecute people with child sex trafficking or anything like that. But the real deal is whether or not the people of Oklahoma are going to fall for this trap of this tough on crime, scare the pants off of you trap. That prosecutors and law enforcement have long done to pass all of these broken criminal justice laws to begin with. So, you know, I think that all of these arguments that this ties the hands of prosecutors and will lead to more crime, they are beyond disingenuous. And really what they are is a grasping at trying to maintain the power the district attorneys have over the accused in the state of Oklahoma.
One of the other things that they have a problem with, Ryan, and I got to ask you about this, and Neva, correct me if I'm wrong, but this actually changes the Constitution, which means you wouldn't have lawmakers being able to come in and change this anyway unless you do another constitutional vote of the people. So I think that's where they're saying the overreach. Do you think it goes too far in not being able to change it later on?
I think that, you know, one of the reasons that you put something like this in the Constitution to begin with is we've seen that the people of Oklahoma are much further ahead of where the legislature is when it comes to criminal justice reform. lawmakers are still very susceptible to the incredibly powerful lobby of district attorneys who go to the state capitol, and they tell legislators these fanciful stories about how public safety will be impacted if they lose their power or lose any bit of their power. And lawmakers are very susceptible to those arguments. The people of Oklahoma largely see through it. And so if you don't put something like this in the Constitution, like we saw with State Question 780, State Question 780 passed in 2016 overwhelmingly, and the criminal justice reform movement had to spend a year plus after that protecting 780 from rollback efforts in the state legislature. So you put this in the Constitution because, frankly, as a matter of constitutional principle, it should be a right of all Oklahomans that once you have served your time for a nonviolent sentence, you've served your time for that, paid all your debts, that you shouldn't have that held over your head for offenses that you may be accused of 10, 15, 20, 30 years later. And that's what we have right now is, you know, folks have that held over their head for decades or for the rest of their life. And I think most Oklahomans feel like if you've served your time, you've served your time, especially when it comes to nonviolent offenses. And that's what this is. It's a power grab by prosecutors trying to beat this back at the ballot box. I don't think they'll be successful, but it's going to be incumbent upon the 805 campaign to really drive that message home with Oklahoma voters.
And I think when we talk about driving the message home, I mean, on the no side, the message there clearly seemed to be seizing on is the fact that they believe the state question lessens punishment for repeat felons who commit the same sorts of crimes. And in the instance of making determinations, I mean, one of the issues I think that will be brought out are certain crimes that are domestic violence charges, for instance, certain domestic violence crimes that do not fall, you know, do not fall under the category that they believe that they should. So this is a case where everyone will use illustrations to make their point as powerful as possible. But at the end of it, I think it will get down to, are the voters clear on what this does? And I think Michael's point of when you start talking about putting any state question into the Constitution, when it goes to that degree, then I think people do pause and takes more serious consideration of that particular fact because they know how permanent it is. It's much more difficult once it's in the Constitution to begin to make any changes down the road.
A ballot measure to make recreational marijuana legal in Oklahoma gets stricken from the ballot. The state Supreme Court finds the gist is misleading. Ryan, what happened here?
Well, the gist was misleading. it was just plain and simple. The person who challenged this, you know, Paul Tay, the perennial ballot challenger right now out there, and he finally, you know, somebody texted me, they said Paul Tay finally won one. But in all fairness, not to give Paul Tay too much credit, if you read the gist of the state question, it is the most ridiculous gist. I mean, it's not until the last sentence of the gist that they even say anything about what the policy would have possibly done in the state of Oklahoma. It really is just a laundry list of complaints about the way the state has administered the medical marijuana program since its passage in 2018. And then you get to the very last sentence and there's some inkling of what it might do if this ballot measure passed. It was a terribly written gist. I think that they never would have got the signatures to put it on the ballot to begin with. This was not a serious effort at marijuana reform, at criminal justice reform, or advancing, what we've built on with State Question 788. I mean, this was not building on that. This was just kind of a non-serious attempt at creating adult use marijuana. The serious attempt at adult use marijuana in Oklahoma was State Question 807, which we withdrew whenever it became clear that we couldn't responsibly collect signatures during a pandemic. But this one seemed like a pretty easy decision for the court to reach.
Neva.
I would agree. I mean, based upon all that's been said, it was a good decision on the Supreme Court's part. I think it is a question, the larger question of recreational marijuana and proponents that want to move on this effort down the road. I don't think we've seen the end of the discussion, obviously. It's just a question of timing and in the COVID pandemic age, I mean, how long that goes and how that impacts someone looking at trying to move it toward the voters making a decision on it at the ballot box. But I think in the instance of looking at just the whole notion of recreational marijuana and a petition down the road, it is interesting that we find that we find lawmakers. I mean, I've heard, you know, on both sides of the aisle, folks talking about the fact that the legislature may, in fact, want to look at this in a more serious manner. Some of these folks, I mean, look at the idea of it being kind of a money grab. I mean, if they pass it and have the opportunity to grab millions of dollars from folks in surrounding states that would come to Oklahoma with it being legalized in the state, I think that's a stretch. And I'm not sure, as we've talked about before, there's much of an appetite for Oklahoma voters to pass something like this. But it'd be interesting to see what the conversation is around the legislature in the next session.
Ryan? Yeah, I think you're right, Neva. I think that the legislature may take this up this upcoming session. You know, a lot of people will ask me, as a former proponent of State Question 807, the adult use marijuana and criminal justice reform measure that we were advancing through that campaign. They say, why do we need recreational marijuana in Oklahoma? We already have these very liberal medical marijuana laws in Oklahoma. Don't we already kind of have de facto adult use marijuana already? And the answer to that is just simply no, we don't. There are barriers to getting a medical marijuana card. And we still see people going to jail and prison for marijuana offenses that they ought not go to prison or jail for. And then, you know, I guess on the other side of that, like you said, Neva, the revenue question, I think that it would potentially bring in tens of millions of dollars of revenue. Medical marijuana is a medicine. And typically, we don't try to raise revenue on the backs of people accessing their medicine. That's why when we think about taxes on pharmaceuticals, I mean, we don't want to tax that stuff to try to raise revenue the way that we would with adult use. Adult use gives us a chance to have a much higher tax rate, to give us a much higher tax rate that would allow us to generate tens of millions of dollars for the state of Oklahoma that we just are leaving on the table right now.
A new poll shows President Trump and Senator Jim Inhofe hold double-digit leads over their major opponents in the upcoming general election. The Amber Integrated Survey shows Trump beating Joe Biden 55% to 33% and Inhofe beating Democratic opponent Abby Broyles 46% to 30%. Neva, not much of a surprise here.
No surprise and no real big change in these numbers. I mean, we'll see polls coming out week in and week out leading up to the election. But the bottom line is, when you look particularly at the Senate race, we have the Senate race in Oklahoma judged as a safe seat, safe Republican seat by virtually every national group that monitors elections and handicaps races across the country. Senator Inhofe's race is one of eight safe Republican seats by Real Clear Politics. There's five Democrat seats nationwide that are considered safe seats for the Democrats. So I think there we have a campaign going on. There will be the give and take and the hard fought race on both sides. But at the end of it, Jim Inhofe will come forward with a resounding victory on November 3rd, just as we see the polls indicate that Donald Trump once again will carry the state of Oklahoma on November 3rd.
Ryan.
You know, Neva, you mentioned that there's a campaign going on for United States Senate. I think we see some of the traditional machinations of a campaign and TV ads that have gone up, but we don't see some of the more traditional parts of a campaign where, you know, we've got the two candidates standing on a debate stage and debating one another and lifting up their ideas. You know, I wonder in 2020 what the real benefit of a debate is. There's not a lot of undecided voters out there, but I do think it's important from time to time, especially when we're talking about a United States senator who's elected for a 6-year term. You know, it's you know, we're in this context of looking at a potential appointment to the Supreme Court, a lifetime appointment to the judiciary here, to the highest court in the land. What I see is a lot of United States senators acting like they have lifetime appointments. You know, it's not a 6-year term, it's a lifetime appointment. I think that Senator Inhofe has got to the point where he just takes for granted that he's going to be reelected. And even if you've got a strong lead, which, you know, polls seem to indicate that he does, I do think that Oklahomans deserve to hear from their United States senator, deserve to hear their United States senator's ideas tested against an opponent on a debate stage. You know, whether that would change the outcome of the election or not, I do think that it's just an important norm as part of our democratic process that when you're up for re-election, you stand before the voters and you stand before them with live cameras rolling, not in a slick produced campaign ad that your consultants have put together for you and do a huge media buy. I mean, that's not enough. So I'm hoping that in spite of a strong lead here, that Senator Inhofe will come out from behind the curtains and have an honest conversation with the people of Oklahoma and do it on the same stage as Abby Broyles.
And even Abby Broyles had been hitting him hard, hitting Jim Inhofe hard on not doing a debate. So why would he not do a debate?
Well, I think it remains to be seen whether there's a debate or not. There's still plenty of time for a debate to take place potentially. But going back to Ryan's assertion about getting before the voters, Jim Inhofe has been in the Senate since 1994. He's run for re-election multiple times, put his record and his campaign forward in 77 counties across Oklahoma. He is well known. Voters understand who he is, have followed his track record in the U.S. Senate, and consequently, he has been an extremely popular political figure in Oklahoma politics for decades. And I think in this instance, when you have a challenger that is largely underfunded, they have to look for every avenue possible to try to engage and try to make this contrast. But it's very difficult. I mean, and even national Democrat groups who loathe Jim Inhofe and you would expect would come in and spend money and try to prop up the Democrat nominee to make it a more competitive race. We just haven't seen that because they know the voters in Oklahoma have made up their minds largely on this race and that Jim Inhofe is in a very good place to win re-election one more time.
A bipartisan group of young lawmakers are coming together to form the Future Caucus. It includes Republicans and Democratic legislators from the House and Senate under the age of 45. Organizers say the goal is supporting bills with long-range efforts to improve life for Oklahomans in areas of education, healthcare, and the economy. Ryan, what do you think of the Future Caucus?
I think that it's good in a political environment that we have right now where folks have largely retreated to their silos. I think we've mentioned a couple of times, at least on this recording, that there aren't a lot of undecided voters out there. And I think that that's largely a reflection of a broken two-party system that has doubled down on dividing Americans into varying political camps. And you know, watching the presidential debate, which was just a debacle of a debate, just embarrassing of a debate with President Trump just interrupting and doing all of the things that we expect President Trump to do, this bombastic politics of division style that he has that's been adopted almost writ large by the Republican Party. It is good to see efforts by politicians at the state and local level to try to come together and find some common ground. I think that that's good. I will say that your power in a caucus like that has to extend beyond issuing press releases. If they really want this Future Caucus to have some power, they're going to need to be able to think about how can they lock up on some procedural votes? You know, what can they do to affect leadership to make sure that, you know, they said that they wanted to run maybe a dozen, 20 something bills or something from this caucus. If they want those bills to be heard and voted on and to have some power, they're going to have to lock up in some procedural votes. I think that that's unlikely. You know, in procedural votes, you usually go back to your party and your caucus. But if whether it's the Future Caucus or any of these other bipartisan caucuses, if they can actually lock up on some procedures, procedural votes that are going to just going to happen. I mean, they happen every year, big procedural votes in the state legislature. That's where they could exercise some real power.
Aniva.
Well, I think, first of all, we have to look at what is the State Future Caucus Network. I mean, it's a group of states, Oklahoma being the 30th to join this month, under an umbrella of a larger group called the Millennial Action Project. And that's why this bipartisan group of lawmakers in Oklahoma, just like the other 29 states, are all under 45 years old. They're in both the House and the Senate chambers. There is a actually a congressional version of this as well for bipartisan groups in these respective states. So it's more of a networking and a motivational group to try to engineer some conversation on legislation that they would like to see. But quite frankly, I mean, the politics of caucuses, the politics of legislation inside these state capitals across the country, it's about how you work within leadership, how you work within the structure of who is the majority party. And while these caucuses, as Brian suggests, may have some influence in terms of advancing legislation or even working on the mechanics of trying to engineer some change in terms of how the chambers function or what gets moved forward and discussed as these ideas that they would like to have, it really is just another group. It's a young group of young leaders across the country. They just had their 2020 Future Summit last month. I thought it was interesting that out of 30 states and all of these lawmakers that they're trying to engage across the country, there were 65 legislators that participated from the states that were involved. So I think this was born out of a group several years ago. I think it was back in about 2013 that it was a group of actually college students that had received Harry S. Truman scholarships for public service that got together and kind of brainstormed and began to formulate this group that we see today. I applaud any group that tries to get together and be responsive and responsible and trying to engage. Their idea of bridging the partisan divide, as they describe it, and trying to transform American politics is a big agenda item for them. And we'll look with interest and see how they explore issues and what they do specifically here in Oklahoma in the next year or two.
Ryan and Eva's comments do not necessarily reflect the views of the ACLU, KOSU, its staff, or management. Programs like this are made possible through support from KOSU members who are listeners like you. Consider a gift to KOSU in support of This Week in Oklahoma Politics at kosu.org.